Good evening. Welcome to Writers at Warwick. Please tell me if at any point you can't hear us, because I'm very good at shouting. It's a great pleasure to welcome back Soon Place, one of our national stars and also one of our local authors. I first became acquainted with his work when he published Continent, which is one of the most original books I've ever read. It's one of those books that stays with one forever, really. He's also written many other novels, The Gift of Stones, Arcadia, Signals of Distress, Quarantine, Being Dead, The Devil's Larder, rather dark titles if you ask me. He's won almost too many prizes to list, but I'll give you a few. The Whitbread First Novel Prize, the E.M. Forster Award, the Guardian Fiction Award, and the Gap.
But not the food store.
the Gap Local. International Prize for Literature. As I said before, he's one of the most innovative, unusual, and uncompromising authors that we have in this country. And I can't think of anybody writing in Britain today who writes, who manages to imitate him even. He's also a great champion of young and regional writers, and I hope we can talk about that a little bit later on. One of the things that I enjoy so much about his books is that they are novels of ideas. There's something rather European about them, but they're also very real. Even when they're located in places that are only half real. They're playful, but they're made of sharp and perfect sentences. I dare you to find a sentence in one of his books that isn't perfect. I'm very jealous. He doesn't ever write the same thing twice, and in his new novel, Six, he writes about things I would never have expected him to write about, and so he's going to surprise you now by reading from Six. Welcome, Jim Crace.
I wonder if it would be really nice to know that there's someone out there, apart from the noise you're making. Is it possible for the house lights to come up slightly? Can anyone do that? They can't see anybody. Are they? Okay. If someone could cough every few... Oh, you don't have to cough. I can see you. Excellent. Yes, this is becoming a bit of a ritual, I'm afraid. For me, the Warwick Biennial. I come here every 2 years when a new book is completed, and have the difficult task up until today of having to explain the impact of a book and the meaning of a book before it's published. Because up until today, the last three books that I've read here, Warwick has been the first place. First time I've read from those books, and I've read from those books before the critics have told me what they're about, before the paint has dried, before the dust has settled on the book. And usually I describe what the impulse for the book was, but then subsequently, about 6 months later, I wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat and thinking, what a fool you made of yourself at Warwick. You got the book completely wrong. And it takes a time for me to realize actually what the book's about. But on this occasion, it's a much less scary occasion for me to some extent, because the paint has dried a bit and the dust has settled a bit and the critics have had their say, unfortunately. And I do now have a sense of what the book is about. But imagine that the book isn't published yet and I had come here 3 or 4 months ago while the book was being written. And this is what I would have told you. I would have told you that of all of the various narratives around in the end of the 20th century, the 21st century, since I was born, the one that is exciting me most as someone who is interested in natural history and the natural world, the thing that has excited me most as being a great narrative is the narrative of Darwinism. And if you were to look at my books, you would find in book after book the imprint of Darwinism, the view that the world is enclosed by our consciousness, and there is nothing that predates it and nothing that follows it, but that natural history and the natural world is wonderful. But I would also be admitting that there's something about Darwinism that has constantly bothered me over the last 10 years. And that is what seems to me to be a gaping hole in the principles of Darwinism. And now I'm going to generalize awfully, so please don't yell out in dismay when I misrepresent all the complexities of Darwinism. But I think we can safely say that one of the essentials of Darwinism is that by Darwinist principle, the successful creature and the successful species is the creature or species that hands on its gene packet the most successfully. The creature that can turn out 1,000 versions of its gene packet in its offspring is more successful than the one that produces none. And in fact, extinction is very largely based on that kind of idea. Clearly, however, to apply that test of success to one species, our species, and us as individuals, isn't going to work. It was ludicrous to say to judge us as being successful or not successful according to how many times we pass on our gene packet, how many children we have. Is the person with 10 children necessarily more successful than the person with none? Is three better than two? The reason why I think it doesn't work for us is that when you think about the successful mouse who has produced 10 children, 10 little mice, or the successful cockroach who has produced 1,000, you don't ask the bigger question that you ask about a creature that has consciousness like us. Was that a happy life? Was that a fulfilled life? Was that a life that had knowledge? Was that a life which enriched the other mice around it? All you are asking yourself about this creature which has limited consciousness is, did it produce many gene versions of itself? And therefore it did, therefore it's a success. But we are different from all other creatures in the narrative, in the universe, in many respects, but the main respect is that we have consciousness. And consciousness enables us to judge our lives as being successful or failure in a smaller compass than the just do we hand on our gene packet. So that was the starting point for this novel, which was at that time called Genesis. And here is the American edition, which has just arrived, and the Americans are still calling it Genesis because they think they're going to clean up in the Bible Belt when this book comes out in... In England, however, it's called Six because we didn't want to confuse any Genesis, Phil Collins fans. But this was the starting point, to see if I could come up with a character who clearly was a success in broad Darwinist terms, somebody who could produce children at no cost, with great ease, that had no fertility problems. But in every other respect in his life, he was unheroic. He was a failure. So he would fail the test of was his life successful, was his consciousness one that made a worthwhile imprint. But he would pass the test in flying colours of handing on his gene pool. So that's the starting point. And if I read to you just the opening few paragraphs, two paragraphs of the novel, you'll get the idea that that was still in my mind as I started to write. So I'm setting this novel up exactly as I've described it to you in the opening paragraphs of the book. Every woman he dares to sleep with bears his child. So now it is Muetta's turn. Whispering and smudging his ear with her lipstick, her breath a little sour from the garlic in her lunch, she confirms her first, his sixth pregnancy, his sixth at least. She's passed the urine test, she says, an unintended play on words, which she acknowledges in the matinee darkness with half an optimistic smile. The doctor thinks she's 12 or 13 weeks. A baby's due by May. It's early days. Muetta feels, of course, before the morning sickness and the backache start, before the lifetime of anxiety and love, that her pregnancy is a personal blessing. The raven of good fortune has chosen her. It has alighted in her yard, and she's been brushed by its great wing. No other adult explanation matters to her for the time being. She is the lucky one. This is her miracle. They sit together in the cinema, that drafty arthouse cinema down on the wharf, their elbows touching and their jackets spread across their knees, to watch young lovers on the screen, young actors making love or seeming to. She wishes Lix would speak to her, do something more than press her forearm with his own, a kiss perhaps. But he's a film buff and an actor himself. Silence for the colleagues, he usually insists. He won't ever speak, not once a movie has begun. Perhaps it's just as well, this winterish afternoon, the perfect weather for the cinema, that he will make her wait until the end before he answers. He wants to say he feels besieged. Another child? He only has himself to blame. To be so fertile is a curse. So there you see, I hope, what I felt at the time, the Darwinist agenda of the novel put in place, and the novel progressing in the way that I had expected it to, the way that I had ordained it to. But of course, the great thing about narrative and fiction is that if it's going well, and if it starts to flow, the goblin of storytelling who sits on your shoulder while you're doing the writing abandons you and starts to go off in his or her own direction. Are goblins gender-oriented? I don't know. And of course, that's exactly what happened with this book. The moment of abandonment comes, and at that point, the moment of excitement, where your original intentions for the book and the directions that you're asking the book to embark on are abandoned, and new things start to happen. What I began to realize very soon as the book progressed was that this book was a book about oppositions, emotional oppositions. The most obvious emotional opposition that exists in the book is the old opposition that exists between love and sex, and the way in which we want to pretend that there isn't a join, but actually there is a join, and on many occasions there's a big chasm between those two things, regrettably sometimes and not so regrettably at other times. And that also, that gap between love and sex is seen, I think, in a different way by your average man and by your average woman. And that difference is sometimes horribly expressed, I think, by a phrase I heard, I've heard, in fact, all too often, and that phrase that says that sex is the price that women pay for love and children, and that love and children are the price that men pay for sex, which is a horrible view of what we're like. And maybe we recognize part of that, but also part of us rebels against it and wants us to be nobler and grander than that. And part of the new agenda, the imposed agenda, the abandoned agenda of this novel was I wanted to combat that cynical view of the relationship between men and women. But also, I think what I began to realize more and more as this novel progressed was that I was doing something that I do in all my novels, which is to end up writing a book and end up producing a narrative which is actually about storytelling itself. And I suppose that here then is another Darwinism. This is another thing which I think you have to put next to consciousness as being a distinguishing thing that humankind has that no other creature in the universe can compare with. And that is that humankind has this narrative ability, this ability, and I'm sure you'll recognize it, where it's not just to do with writers, it's to do with everyone in this room, this ability to constantly reinvent the past and to imagine the future, to think about the day that we've spent and to put it in new form, to use narrative as a way to get the job, to use narrative as a way to get the boy or girl, to use narrative as a way to be successful socially. Because you all know, don't you, that the last person you want to sit at your table in the pub tonight is the person that has no narrative aspects to their being, the person who is fact-oriented, that can't tell stories, that can't exaggerate, that can't lie socially. We want to avoid that person like a plague. So narrative has been with us for ever since we were talking creatures. It gives us a massive advantage, because if it did not give us an advantage, and here is the Darwinist point, it would have died out. Being narrative creatures confers upon us a massive strength. And that strength is that it enables us to imagine the future and play out alternatives so that we make good decisions. Don't knock narrative, don't knock storytelling, never tell anybody off for lying. It is something which is as essential to us as our consciousness. But of course, it's dangerous. Anything as powerful as that is dangerous. So while I was writing this novel, there was a pre-existing narrative about love and sex and men and women and children and parenthood that was standing at my shoulder, nagging at me and annoying me. And that narrative was the Hollywood narrative of how human beings relate to each other. I realized that taking existing narratives on and trying to correct them is something that I've been doing in previous books. So in Quarantine, my novel, which is set at the 2,000 years ago in the Judean desert, which is about Christ in the wilderness, was my attempt to take on what is, after all, the most influential narrative in the world, the stories that exist in the Bible, the narrative that there is a God, the narrative that Christ was, in my view, is the narrative, the Son of God. The power of narrative in religions is that the stories are the Trojan horses which are now enable the ideas to enter into. This is why the great narrative tradition, religions such as Judaism and Christianity are so strong, because they're not frightened of telling stories to make their point. So Quarantine was very much my retelling of an existing narrative. Being Dead, the next novel that I wrote, which is a novel about death and the finality of death, was my retelling of the fairy tale comforting narrative, which says that when we die, we're going to spend eternity in heaven, spooning up yogurt and honey while we listen to harp music. Well, we're not. When you go, that's it. And that calls for great optimism, actually, rather than pessimism. And so the story that, and the pre-existing narratives that I was retelling with Six, was the narrative of Hollywood. The narrative of Hollywood, which says that everything is reducible to Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. That sexual relationships are clean and contiguous and reliable and always work perfectly for people who are virtuous and good-looking and have full heads of hair and tight little bodies. You can see the bit that annoys me most. Hollywood thinks that when it reduces relationships to that in which the virtue and good looks are synonymous, that somehow this is an optimistic view of the world because good fortune comes to their heroes and their heroines. My view in my fiction is now, and has always been, that it is a deeply cynical view of humankind. It's deeply cynical because it leaves everybody in this audience out, except for one very good-looking chap I noticed earlier. We are all normal-looking. We are all blemished to some extent. And if good fortune and good relationships only happen to people who were physically perfect, then we would all be damned and lost. And so that was the final point, and the major point, I think, of this book, once I'd finished it, I realized, was that it took on Hollywood. It was an attempt to tell the story of a man who was fertile, yes, but also was immensely blemished, but nevertheless succeeded in having relationships, even though those relationships were blemished as well. So instead of Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt, we have some clumsy sex between people who mean well. And I think that when love and children come out of that, that's the optimistic triumph, rather than the kind of offspring that we get from the Hollywood version of things. So, we are going to hear tonight... Oh, wrong book. I can't read from the American edition because they changed all the English words into American. So we'll read the British version. Lix, the actor. The book, I should explain, is broken up into six parts. And in each part is set on the day that Lix produces his next child. What's the word? What produces?
Well, how can it be? Yeah.
Conceive, thank you. Why on earth would I forget the word like conceive? When he conceives his six children. So each of the chapters is on each of those days. And in this last chapter, I'm going to read a section in which Lix conceives his youngest child, Rosa, the one before Muetta. Muetta's the woman that got pregnant at the beginning, and she's pregnant throughout the book, but this is a living child. And he produces it on the 1st of January 2001. But I want you to bear in mind, when you think about that date, I want you to bear in mind that on the last day of 1999, my wife and I were in Paris for the millennium, and the midnight fireworks went off under the Eiffel Tower. It was a great evening. And there was one man walking around with a placard which basically said, "You fools, don't you know your maths? There isn't a year zero. The millennium doesn't start until 2001. There's always somebody, isn't there? And I want you to bear him in mind. So this is about Lix, the actor, and Anita, or Anne, a fellow actress. They'd never truly kissed before, Lix and Anne. It was undeniable, though. There'd been 9,000 witnesses so far that their lips had touched, and had done so every night for 14 weeks, in character, in costume, and on stage, abetted by their scripts. They were obedient professionals. The play demanded that they fall in love, so they obliged convincingly. They were old hands at that. They'd been respectful colleagues, yes, cheerful and supportive. Yet nobody could claim that they were even friends off stage. If they ever coincided in the player's easy room or in the bar behind the theatre, they were polite with each other, but uninvolved. The lively little actress, not so young and not so pretty anymore, and Mr. Taciturn, who led God knows what kind of life since his divorce and his success. The gossip columns couldn't even guess beyond the rumours circulating still that he was either egotistical in bed or impotent. The evidence was thin either way. Lix had no public life, no politics. Reclusive was the word the papers used these days to describe the actor, or better, secretive, because that suggested he was concealing something. You'd not expect a man like that to couple up with Anne, for whom concealment and reclusion were anathema. But this was the break of New Year's Day, New Century's Day, and both of them were lonely and exhilarated by the date, 01-01-01, Conception Day for Rosa Dern. The third millennium for us started 1 year after everybody else's, because some bored and playful speculators from the Tourist Bureau had decided and decreed that the City of Balconies and the City of Kisses could now be marketed for a lucrative month or so as the City of Mathematical Truth, the capital of calendar authenticity, and would thereby reap and thresh the ripest crop of revellers from abroad who'd want a replay of the false new millennium they'd already celebrated so memorably, so profitably, 1 year before. We'd be the only place where you could observe the accurate millennium, they said. We'd be the only town where you could mark the advent of the future twice. Sudden fortunes would be made by hotels, restaurants, and breweries, normally run down for the winter, and by the opportunists from the Tourist Bureau who'd put in place some subtle private deals. So, in expectation of 15,000 out-of-season visitors, all eager to procure a night of pleasure. The bunting and the streamers were prepared. The historic city centre was closed to traffic. The whole of Company Square was equipped with braziers and licensed for the sale of alcohol. The airport lobby was emblazoned with the banners, "The time is right at last for having fun," and "Welcome to the city that truly counts." Prostitutes took rooms downtown, and women, hoping to be wifed abroad, bought new provoking clothes and carried their final school grades in their evening bags as proof. And a midnight fireworks show, which would be visible from the moon, they said, was readied on Navigation Island in the mud. The foreign revelers, regrettably, were sick of New Millennia by then. The disappointment and the hangovers of the first would last them for 1,000 years. One anticlimax was enough. Therefore, they did not come to us in their expected droves. Instead, our hotels were half filled with maths curmudgeons, mostly male, Dutchmen, Scandinavian and Yanks, academics, intellectuals and bachelors, who'd refused the year before to recognize the numerically premature end of the millennium, but now had got an opportunity to demonstrate their bloody-mindedness and learning. Imagine it, on New Year's Eve, our city full of nitpickers, hair splitters, pedants and rationalists, and local women dressed like queens, scaring them to death with their grade C's in science, languages and art. And what did these maths curmudgeons want to do to celebrate the passing year? They wanted to avoid the crowds. In fact, the streets were full enough that night, with citizens. We've always liked a fireworks show and alcohol and women in provoking clothes. There is indeed good cause for all of us to celebrate, Jupiter wrote in his Sunday column on New Year's Eve. Contrary to the evidence of our own eyes, we are making measurable progress in this city. Now we are only a year behind the rest of the world. Let's see if we can close the gap by 3001. Licks had been on stage till 10 in his revival of The Devotee, not the most testing of romantic comedies, but an easy and welcome opportunity for him to sing and act and show his famous face before an uncritical audience that normally would not spend time or money in the theatre. No need to exert himself, no need for nuances or subtlety. Just be certain, he reminded himself before each performance, that the laughter clears before the next amusing line, and that the next amusing line is timed to end before the laughter starts. And don't forget, of course, his stage director said, to beam and bounce. The audience did not want art at that time of the year, or intellectual theatre. They'd only come that evening anyway to pass the time before midnight by watching two luminaries make love on stage, and then to boast they'd seen the celebrated Licks in the flesh. They'd seen his birthmark, and they'd seen his shaved and naked chest. What's more, they'd watched their television star, the man who'd made a fortune from his songs about their city, kissing Anita Julius, the actress who was equally famous for her Channel Beta talent show, her range of tempers, and for her fleeting love affairs with older men and younger men, men with chauffeur-driven cars, and then the chauffeurs too. So, when finally, and as the curtain closed, Anne and Licks reached the moment of that much-vaunted promised kiss, the one the theatre posters reproduced, the one so many times reprinted in the magazines, the one that all the gossip columnists would use when the scandal broke on New Year's Day, the otherwise attentive audience grew tense and quiet. Opera glasses were lifted up. People shifted in their seats to gain the clearest view. Men licked their lips and cleared their throats, as if they believed their turn would come, that Anne would jump down off the stage to plant her lovely lips on theirs. Not one single person looked elsewhere. They watched through narrowed eyes. You'd think that Life magazine had got it wrong in 1979 when it recorded so much affection on our streets, and that for us public kissing was still as exotic, rare and disconcerting as a total eclipse. It wasn't only the actual kiss that mesmerized and silenced them. It was also the unexpected display of what they mistook as privacy. the unembarrassed breaching of a hidden world that only chambermaids and paparazzi ever stumbled on. Four famous lips engaged in lovemaking, while all the world, sunk and squirming in their seats, looked on and felt the pangs of exclusion. Here was a life denied to ticket holders in the audience, a life of cash and fame and sex and unself-consciousness. No wonder no one dared to breathe or be the first to clap. The audience that night was witnessing something new and dangerous. However, in every performance until this one, on New Year's Eve, the lovers kissing had been a cleverly rehearsed sham. They were, to use the actor's phrase, kissing like puppets, or dry drinking, their lips stitched shut, their mouths as passionate and hard as stones, their breaths held in until the kissing was completed. It's true, all the audiences so far had seen both Lix and Anne put out their tongues a little as their faces closed in, as their noses touched. A little strip of reflective mouth gel achieved that trick. The stage lights had caught the wet and fleshy tongue tips, exactly as the stage director planned. It might have looked as if the actors' mouths were busy with each other's tongues. Everyone would swear to that. But they'd been fooled. They wanted to believe. They wanted to be duped. What was rolling in the actors' cheeks, convincing the galleries and the stalls that this was more than theatre, was only the mockery of tongues. Lix and Anne were performing in the pockets of their own mouths, with their own tongues, playing solo trumpet is the term, with no more sensual passion than they'd need to free a wedge of toffee from their teeth. That's show business. It's trickery and counterfeit. The actors have to seem to care when they do not. The fact was this, however it appeared on stage. Until the final act on New Year's Eve, their tongues had never touched. Anne did not truly fancy Lix, no matter what the gossips and the posters might imply, no matter what they did on stage, he did not truly fancy her. Yet, if the theatre was powerful and could transform an audience, then how could it not affect the principals themselves, eventually? How could their nightly kissing on the stage not spill over into life, particularly on New Year's Eve, when all the cast and all the staff, including Lix and Anne especially, had oiled the way by drinking to each other's health before the show? It isn't love that's blind, it's alcohol. And so she becomes pregnant. And this book is a book without children for 99% of its time. The book is pregnant with the child that Muetta is going to have, and it is also sort of pregnant with the children that you know are born but do not meet. And what happens at the end of the book, and when we've had a Q&A, I'm just going to read another page and a half to you. What happens at the end of the book is that the book delivers to you, the reader, all of the children at one go, in the same way that at the end of a pregnancy, a child is produced. The end of a pregnancy in which you have been spending 9 months living the narrative of what that child is going to be, imagining that child's before and after, thinking the stories of that child which you just don't know about, you might not even know its sex. And at the end of the narrative of pregnancy, a child is produced. And what I will do at the very end, when we've had a Q&A, is I will just introduce you in a page and a half to three of the children.
Thank you very much. Thank you also for giving me my lecture for tomorrow. We're doing one course, and one of us is teaching narrative. I'm teaching narrative, and my colleague behind me is teaching anti-narrative, and we're going to see who wins.
Oh, gosh, which one should I go to?
Well, I'm going to use everything that you said, so okay. I'll win. Yeah. One of the things that is really striking about this book is that the main character, Lix, disappears every time he conceives a child. He ceases to be. He ceases to be important. And so if I were writing a story about six pregnancies, that's where the story would begin. And the story would not probably include the man as the most important person, What are you thinking? What are you trying to say by repeating that in every single?
Well, he's not going to disappear from Weta. He's there.
You know what I mean. It's about his importance.
Well,
the story of the child.
The book is full of strong women. Women who aren't necessarily beautiful, but are tough and achieving.
Sometimes
beautiful, but difficult as well. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, I mean, one of the indulgences about writing a book is that you get to spend your time with people that you like. And so I spent the year that I was writing this book in the company of some women that, if I hadn't been married for almost 30 years, or I could turn the clock back and was 19, would like to spend some time with. So they are strong, powerful women.
Was it
and
research or
unfortunately, no. I couldn't persuade myself that I should research this thoroughly. So it's all in my imagination. And in fact, my imagination works like this because I'm not an autobiographical writer in any way. You won't learn anything about my sex life, I promise you, by reading this book, any more than you will learn much about my attitudes or anything about reading my books, because that point of abandonment removes me. I'm not an autobiographical writer.
I know
you're not accusing me of being that, but
no.
I just wanted to say this anyway. Yeah. And so what happens is that when I go into go into my office to write, I visit things that I cannot visit in my life.
Yeah.
And therefore I visit weak people, and I visit dark corners and all of those kind of things, because that is of interest to me. So that's what happens in the book. But Lix, I hope, is a likable character, even though he's weak.
Mm.
And I hope that the women in it are strong and likable without compromise, is my hope.
All of that is true. I'm just trying to... I'm intrigued by the way you challenge the usual narrative about birth, and certainly the female narrative about conception, birth, and so on. And it's the male version, this story, from the point of view of the man, is not a version that we hear very often. So I'm just trying to tease
that's
out.
That's right. You have to strip it back.
What emerges?
If you're looking, the best optimism is found in the darkest corners. This is always my view. If you tell a story of a man who has had six children and two wives, the first wife has died, so there's no question of anyone cheating on anybody, and he brings them up, and he puts them on his lap every night, and he reads them stories, and he bathes them, and he changes their nappies, and he cooks for them, and they run to him and call him daddy and hug him like mad. That is no context. That is not, of course parenthood is wonderful in those circumstances. That is not to push parenthood into a tight corner and make it argue. But if in this book you have someone that actually is a very bad father, a neglectful father, and we are asked at the end of the novel to judge him, has he achieved anything? And what I feel the optimistic message of this book is that even given his sexual failures, that he's not even sexually successful. I mean, he's only ever slept with five women in his life. Even though he's got this great fertility, he's not exactly a stud.
He's timid.
He's very, very timid. Even though he's timid about claiming his children to himself, even though he has neglected them, even though they've been brought up without a father, the great product of this, and this begins takes me back to my my Darwinist argument in the end, that maybe I'm coming around to a Darwinist view on this book. There is a triumph. That out of all this neglect, out of all this timidity, there are six lives.
Yeah.
And that's why he's absent, to make those six lives valuable.
Moving away from the children, I'm just fascinated by this, and so I'm just going to pin you down a little bit, try to pin you down.
I have not read this book, I have to say, so I don't know.
You haven't read it.
You don't read your own book, do you? You never read it.
But the interesting thing that Lix is saying, or that the book is saying through Lix, has to do more with pregnancy and that sort of the first 9 months, the invisible 9 months of a child's life, than afterwards, because there's a strong sense that he plays no part in this. And sometimes some of the mothers actually make this very clear. He's not a factor once he's donated his sperm.
Yeah.
And you said something very quickly while you were still up at the podium about somehow creating paternity through narrative.
Mm.
And from the point of view of a woman of many pregnancies, I don't have to do that. I don't have to invent narrative for a child because the child is part of me at that time. So I was wondering if you had anything to say about
narrative. When you were pregnant, you weren't thinking about the child. You weren't.
you're wondering, actually you know that the child is somebody, and you might find out, but you have a very strong physical, or you have a very intimate physical relationship with that child. And so you never have to, in my experience, invent the story in the same way that I've had to invent stories about almost everything else in my life. It's the one thing you don't have to imagine. And I always felt that it was very difficult for a man to travel through a pregnancy at the same time, because there was not that connection. And I always felt that the one of the first things that traditionally a man could do would be to give a name. Anyway, that's
Well, that might be right. I do know that when my wife was pregnant, I would always my imagination would be fertile with imagining this child, and that was one of the great things. It's like looking forward to a holiday, isn't it? It's like a huge long holiday that's going to follow, but it's like looking forward to a holiday. And I think that I constantly am perhaps a more narrative creature than others, but I mean, we're all narrative creatures, as I said, but perhaps I'm more narrative. And of course the biggest narrative that we tell ourselves is particularly men, I think, and women of course as well, but men are, from experience I can tell you, are constantly telling themselves sexual narratives. And when you're younger, it's permanent, it's all day, it's 25 hours a day, you're telling yourself sexual narratives. And this is the one narrative that you don't share with anybody. This is the one narrative you only tell yourself to produce certain results. You know, either for masturbatory reasons or to produce some kind of arousal or to make up for gaps in your life. But if you were looking for a personal, domestic example for how powerful narrative can be, then just remind people how often we tell ourselves stories about sex. And so in a way that was why the book is set on the day of conception, because the day of conception is where the invented version, our invented worlds collide with our real world. The invented world of our sex life is more like Hollywood than the real world of proper relations.
Moving to a slightly different area, in all your writing, you have a very strong sense of place and a very interesting way of creating place. And one of the most interesting characters in this book is the city itself, which does have a history, and the history is somehow like our own. There were, you know, there was a radical moment. There was the year of laxity is 1979. It wasn't. That's the change you make. How do you go about creating these worlds, and how do you know not to go too far, and how do you know how to make the mix work?
There's nothing unusual in what I do.
Most people do it badly, and you do it very well.
Well, I don't think many. I think that the realist novel. I mean, there are many real cities. People make love and have children, and get divorced in Warwick and Woomera and Wellington. I could have set this in a real place. But I see myself as a much more traditional storyteller than that. Most of the traditional stories of the world, and most of the stories that exist in this country sort of before the Jane Austen period in the last 200 years, are not realist novels. They tend to be invented novels and invented landscapes. There were no caves in Crete. There is no Minotaur. These things are just inventions to serve a purpose. And so really what I'm doing is old-fashioned storytelling. Starting from scratch, that's what I want to do. I don't want to set my novel in a real Birmingham, which is my hometown, because a real Birmingham has got certain streets and certain terrible shops and certain new developments and certain suburbs. And I would have to hold my mirror still and get it right. But I want the freedom to say exactly what I want and to make up exactly what I want. And so if I start from scratch, I can invent absolutely everything that I need. If I need an unusual creature, I can invent that creature. If I need a river which behaves in bizarre ways that no other river in the world does, I can invent that river. And so that's what I do. However, my methodology in inventing this is to tell my lies as if they are facts. To present to you this these invented places and these invented creatures and these invented habits as if they were real. This town is so real, I want you to believe that you can go to Birmingham Airport and take an easy jet there tomorrow. That's my intention.
And an awful lot of people who do invent their terrains and who do draw upon myth, get, what's the word, it's rather facile, it's lacking in narrative tension. How do you make sure you create a landscape that can, as it were, fight back?
God, you know.
You know.
I don't know any of these questions, yeah. But I tell you what it is. That when you're embarked on a novel, I'm sure you recognise this. You're like a tightrope walker. You're walking a tightrope, and you don't want to think about it too much because what you're doing is intuitive.
But actually, there's
only one place for you to put your foot next.
Yes.
And so it sounds scary and it sounds difficult, but that rope is very very straight and it's very very narrow. Mm. And I keep on making this point driving you mad probably, but because narrative is ancient, it has its forms.
Yes.
And in the same way that someone who is an intuitive natural musician will not ever hit a bad note, even though they're extemporizing, when you're writing fiction, you've got all of these pre-existing stories which tell you what works and what doesn't. You've got this.
You disobey them. You disobey the stories. That's again one of the interesting, the center of the most interesting thing in your writing is that you challenge those narratives, as you said. And I mean, it's not just the Hollywood narrative that you're challenging.
But all the best narratives challenge it. All the best people in the pub when they come in and they've had a few drinks and they're really swimming and they're in a great mood and they start talking, and they're not thinking about what they're saying, but they're really flying. And we've all done this. You know, it's your night. Mm. You're talking really well. You're at a dinner party. Boy, everyone's looking at you, what's she on? Mm. And when it happens, you're stitching into something which is beyond yourself, and it really comes out strangely and bizarrely, and you talk well. You don't follow well-tread paths because that doesn't alert anybody. You strike off in places no one's been before. And so even though I'm disobeying the conventions, I'm not actually breaking the big rules,
okay.
the law of physics where...